Hi, this is Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. We always like to know what you think about what we're doing. Today, we're talking with Barron's Gene Epstein. He's one of the best economic journalists. He's been plying the trade for decades now. He's the author of the great book, Ecospinning. And recently, he's written a bunch of stories about both about Barack Obama's economic legacy as well as Donald Trump's economic plans for the country. So we're going to talk to him about how Obama did vis-a-vis the economy and how Trump is likely to do. Gene, thanks for talking to us.
A pleasure, Nick.
And I should mention also as well that Gene Epstein is the father of Reason TV producer and Reason.com journalist Jim Epstein, in case anybody was wondering. But that really, it just means that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, right? Right, Gene?
Not in Jim's case, anyway.
Yes. So let's talk about Obama's economic legacy. You know, as he were, you know, days away from him leaving office and exiting the public stage, we're in an era of unprecedentedly low unemployment, low inflation, steady if low growth. What's to complain about Obama's 8-year economic legacy?
Well, the unemployment rate is low. It's not unprecedentedly low. It is low, and we are indeed actually pretty much at a full employment economy, which I think is an important point to stress about where Trump is going to bring us. But getting to Obama, the only reason we've got such a low unemployment rate is that so many prime age men, prime age women have chosen not to participate in the labor force. And that a large part of that, a lot of it is always going to be a mystery, but a large part of that can be attributed to policies of the federal government that sort of trapped people, that created disincentives, the most egregious, most extreme being the surge in disability payments over a period, over the last, actually, of course, 10, 20 years, when disability filings should have been down, mainly because dangerous work has declined, and also even what remains as dangerous work is safer than it used to be. You would have expected a decline in disability payments, but so, because of various policies by the government, it's been soaring, and those people are not showing up for work.
And this is something you know, that started at least under George W. Bush, if not H.W.
Yes.
Bush. So I mean, basically,
right.
you're
yes.
you're arguing that work has been getting safer and on-the-job injuries have become a rarer and less serious
yes.
when they do happen. So
the population is generally healthier mm-hmm. and so on. All the signs should have pointed to the exact reverse trend.
So,
and by the way, you mentioned – go ahead. Yes,
yeah, no,
go ahead.
Please continue.
You mentioned George W. Bush. See, I believe that a lot of what explains the slowdown in economic growth since the year 2000, that is under George mm-hmm. W. Bush and under Barack Obama, has been the fairly steady decline in the Economic Freedom Index for the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
The bipartisan story actually from the 70s, 80s, and 90s is that the Economic Freedom Index generally rose, and those
so
were periods reasonably
wait,
fast growth. But since 2000, we slowed down.
Okay,
yeah.
So, you know, ballpark figures, what was general annual economic growth between about 1970 and 2000? It was, what, around
3-4%? Well, the expansion periods were about 3.5%, say, 4%, mm-hmm. and in good quarters. So we did well. In the 90s, for example, we had a 3.4% rate of growth. Well, 3.5%
yeah.
or higher through any of these periods.
Since 2000,
under Bush, it's been 2.5%. Under Obama, it's been 2.2%.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, we're talking about a full 1 percentage point lower, really 1 to 1.5 percentage points lower, which is, you know, more than just a rounding error. It's
so like
noticeable.
50%, right?
Yeah.
50% of 2%
yeah, sure.
is, and that compounds over
sure.
time, right?
Exactly.
So that
yeah, the compounding, yeah. precisely.
Now,
precisely.
You would... You would say that that is primarily the result of a decrease in economic freedom. What goes into
yes.
the indices of economic freedom, and then how does that translate into lower economic growth?
Well, the causal relationship, I think, is fairly clear when you focus on the five subcomponents. All of these, by the way, I quote only the Fraser Institute in conjunction with the Cato Institute, because the numbers are completely transparent, and they do manage to put numbers on everything where they don't have actual economic data. They base it on numerical surveys. The five components are size of government. When the government gets too large, this is empirically true across countries. They have an index, the index now for nearly 200 countries. They have it for over 100 countries over the last 40, 50 years. Size of government diminishes the economy, is a drag on the economy. Legal system and property rights. Now, that's a positive in this sense, that if the government ensures legal system and property rights in the economy, then that's positive. But to the extent that it compromises those rights, that's negative. The third is sound money. The fourth is freedom to trade. The fifth is business regulation. Now, I guess, you know, I suppose if you're sort of tone deaf about free markets, then it won't occur to you that these factors directly relate to economic growth. Mm-hmm. But certainly the empirical data is compelling across the globe that the worldwide economic freedom index has risen. And of course, it coincides with the fact that large economies like that of China and India have been turning toward free markets. The highest the countries with the highest economic freedom have the highest standards of living. All of it correlates pretty much as you would expect. With respect to the U.S., I think the causal relationship is fairly clear. We had good growth in that 30-year period, a slowdown, which started under Bush. And in fact, the Economic Freedom Index fell more under Bush than it did under Obama. So I do regard it as sort of a Bush-Obama debacle.
Now, do you...
You can't let Obama off the hook.
No, but you also mentioned that fewer people are, as a percentage, are participating in the labor force. That's problematic, right? When you have fewer workers, fewer consumers. Or, well, I guess you have consumers, but not that. And then, what about technology? Because some economists and some analysts say that part of the problem is that we're just not developing the new kind of technologies that historically create big booms. Do you think that's true?
Well, I believe that at the end of the day, that's a kind of a mystical statement. Of course, we're also bombarded with all the fears that jobs are disappearing and the robots are taking over, and that the driverless car is just around the corner. But of course, that hasn't materialized yet. I would say that the one thing, there are mysteries involved with this, but clearly entrepreneurship is stifled if you have the heavy hand of business regulation. If you have Dodd-Frank, if you have banks getting larger, if you have marginal businesses having a greater difficulty getting access to funds, then innovation is stifled. And so I would say that what they are stating is that economic freedom has declined, ergo productivity and innovation has slowed. And that I think is the core of the problem. But if somebody wants to say, a genius comes along only every 7 or 9 years, and we've just been unlucky, difficult to refute him. All I can say is that the actual numbers pretty much fit together. A slowdown in growth, a slowdown in entrepreneurship, innovation, in business formation, all of it connecting with a heavier hand of regulation, with the erosion of legal system and property rights. Bondholders got screwed, for example, when the bailout of General Motors happened, a big decline in trust. All of those things fit together, and I believe they're pretty adequate explanations for the very, very poor performance of the economy under Obama.
What if you could pick one or two major interventions into the economy that Obama either did himself or pushed, what would those be?
Well, I guess I briefly mentioned a couple, which of course are the fairly well-known kind. The bailout of General Motors and of course the complete shafting of auto companies in the South, and then the shafting of the bondholders. Supposedly it had been sacred part of property rights that if you hold a bond in a large company, you're the first to be paid, and that didn't happen under Obama. The unions got the money first. Dodd-Frank. TARP, so many of the policies of Obama were predictably of the kind to strengthen strong banks, to weaken marginal businesses. All of that happened, and clearly we have to, you know, there's nothing wrong with large businesses. It's just that we have to have a reasonably fair game, and large businesses got handouts, got support, got strengthened, and peripheral businesses, the businesses potentially of the future, got choked.
This is the old story of, I guess, what Burton Folsom used to make a distinction between market entrepreneurs who get big because they actually win customers over with lower prices and better services, mm-hmm. versus political, yes. entrepreneurs who have good connections. And one of the outcomes of Dodd-Frank is that the big, mm-hmm. banks got bigger and more concentrated in their ownership of, yes. the financial industry. And for you, that's enough to, yes. say, look, something really messed up is going on here.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Yeah, you know, it's enough. I will say that what I like about the Economic Freedom Index is that it doesn't retrofit the story. It's a set of numbers that discovers as time goes on what's going on. Interestingly, for example, the legal system and property rights number is strictly based on surveys where CEOs of companies, I forget the specific source, I think it's the World Freedom Index people who do this, they pull together a lot of numbers, and businessmen are asked about the reliability of government and a property rights, and they rate it, and those ratings have declined. And so the answer is, you know, we then have to have a focus group and ask them, you know, why are you rating it so low? What's happened? What's different about the atmosphere? So in other words, the numbers speak objectively, and then we have to draw some inferences. There are probably a lot of other subtle things that, mm-hmm. went on when you push me, you know, what exactly is the change in the atmosphere, and I'm choosing the easy examples. There may be, right. more subtle ones, but in any case, what I'm doing then is I'm not giving some kind of after the fact explanation. I'm citing a series of numbers that discover the problems in the economy based on surveys and based on numbers.
Well, without going fully into the morass, yeah. of animal spirits that John Maynard Keynes talked about, we can,
yes.
go,
okay.
pivot from Obama to Trump, you know, I mean, because it's partly right that business owners are like, you know, I got a bad feeling that some, you know, and this happened under Bush, you know, Bush famously during the financial crisis said, you know, I believe in free markets, and in order to save the free market economy, I'm going to totally intervene in it.
Yes.
And with Obama, people are like, okay, what's coming next? Is it going to be another type of regulation? Is it going to be a minimum wage increase, et cetera? They get a little bit skittish. Donald Trump, you know, he's a businessman. He's a billionaire. He said he wants to make America great, and he's going to get rid of all these regulations. Do you feel comfortable, yeah. with Trump's economic priorities? And do you think he will be not just better than Obama, but will he be good for the American economy, or is he a disaster waiting to unfold?
All right, that's the toughest question you've asked so far, Nick. Mm. And, well, let me just mention one thing about, you know, the animal spirits, you know, that Keynesian concept. Yeah. You know, reminds me of John Allison's joke that, you know, that supposedly the Great Recession was caused by deregulation and greed. And Allison said, you know, supposedly there was just a big increase in greed in 06 and 07.
Right.
Animal spirits are always there. There are plenty of businessmen in the U.S. economy, plenty of innovators, plenty of immigrants who come to this country, yeah. who want to do great things. And so that's pretty much of a constant.
But and it's true that there is a question about uncertainty, is another way of putting it.
Yes.
Like, you know, if
yes.
you're uncertain about, you know, it's hard enough to make a buck in a business, you know, in boom, yeah. times, really. But,
yes.
you know, when you add,
yes.
to uncertainty by saying, OK, there's a financial meltdown all around the globe, plus we have no idea what the government's going to be doing from one day to the next. That's a recipe
that's
for,
right.
freezing people up.
Right. Okay. Now you formulated it to my complete,
yes,
satisfaction.
I take the point is taken, Professor. So we'll talk about Trump Trump's. So talk about Trump's economic priorities. In a recent piece at Barron's, headlined something like "Trump on Trade: His Worst Idea Are Trade Barriers."
Yeah. Well,
so
yeah.
What do you mean? What do,
yeah.
you mean by that?
Well, you know, we. it's clear enough that if he really meant that he wants, happily, he hasn't said this in a while, I believe, you know, 45% tariffs on imports from China, 35% on imports from Mexico, two of our largest trading partners, then that would be a kind of a Smoot-Hawley problem. Smoot-Hawley, of course, being the infamous act of 1930 that accelerated the economic downturn that led to the Great Depression. The signs are there, unfortunately, that he's going to do some bad things about trade. There's no question that we have a situation in which business depends on goods that they can buy. And I mention business because it's important to stress that that more than half of the goods that business, and indeed services that business imports, are go to business. They're not consumer goods. Mm-hmm. And so it's what we call these supply chains that business depends on. Cheap steel, no consumer brings steel home. You bring products that consists of steel. Mm-hmm. And so cheap steel is good for jobs, good for the flourishing of our domestic businesses. And if Trump is going to make it more difficult and more expensive to import these capital and intermediate products, then domestic business is going to suffer. And while it's now rather troubling that, as I imagine you know, his three picks for people who are going to have responsibility about trade, that's Wilbur Ross, Peter Navarro, Robert Lighthizer, who have three key jobs having to do with trade, that they are all very strongly protectionist oriented. And so they can do some mischief even unilaterally from their position, they can do mischief. The only hope is that unlike the 1930s, when virtually all we imported really was finished consumer goods, there now is a huge business interest in cheap imports because they are the ones who buy the imports, and so business could indeed push back. The Republican Congress has by and large been friendly toward trade and against protectionism. So they might push back. That's my hope.
Does it give you pause, though, that according to Pew and Gallup and a couple of other polling places, that recently Democrats are actually more free trade? They're more likely to agree with pollsters when they say, do you think that free trade agreements such as NAFTA or the Trans-Pacific Partnership benefit America? Wow. And Republicans are now more likely to say no, they don't. Trump ran on that and he won on the idea he's Canute holding back the waves of not just of Mexican workers but of Mexican Corollas, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. No. Well, of course. You've asked the toughest question of all, which is easy enough for me to explain that Obama's economic legacy has been terrible. Predicting the political economic environment right now is tough, and you've introduced a point I was not aware of. I guess the Republican voters who are polled are just persuaded about what the Republican president-elect has been gabbing about. So I suppose that's what they've been saying. I will say that I did regard. Well, I regarded Hillary Clinton as a real danger in so many ways. It seemed to me that she would be more friendly toward free trade, right, for sure, than Trump was. And that's, of course, an easy comparison. So it's up for grabs. I just imagine, though, that Republican senators and congressmen have not completely given up. And then, as I say, my hope is that businesses that do have a lot of power in Washington that are so dependent on imports will organize and not totally be cowed by the president-elect. I could be wrong. So that's the big negative with respect to Trump. And again, his appointments, Ross, Navarro, and Lighthizer, have been very, very discouraging.
In your piece on Trump on trade barriers, one of the things you point out is that, it's this immense success story of the past 50 years, really. And I guess actually of post-World War II, post-World War II order, of the reduction in trade barriers and tariffs and whatnot, which, you know, has enriched everybody's life, I think. But then you mentioned that politically connected businesses, and this I had not seen before, still managed to get carve-outs. And so that you wrote that we have 35% tariffs on tuna, 25% tariffs on light trucks, 16% on wool sweaters. Peanuts come – importing peanuts, you get charged a tariff of 131%. That's amazing, and it's but it's stunning, isn't it, that people don't have a more kind of higher comfort level with free trade in goods and services? Because you also pointed out that it's almost – it's $800 billion a year that we send abroad in the form of services. So you're hoping your big hope, and it's something I hadn't thought about before, is that all of the businesses that benefit from trade, they tend to, you know, have the ear of politicians, right? So they'll push back against the attempt to kind of create tariff walls.
Right. Benefit from the cheap imports, and indeed, you alluded to services. You know, the it's we have a huge surplus in something that people have put trouble putting their mind around, the fact that we are exporting services big time. It's not just Hollywood. I guess that's an easy example. That's a service. You know, the stuff
What are the types of services that we export then?
We dominate, you know, it's our intellectual capital. We dominate in legal services, investment services, real estate, architecture, engineering. We just have the best and the brightest, the smartest people who sell their services abroad, and our surplus. You quoted the $800 billion. That, and quite right. That's the gross deficit for goods. But we have a nearly $300 billion surplus in services that reduces the overall deficit to about $500 billion.
Wow.
So indeed, it's pretty large. And again, it's almost any kind of high skilled work you can imagine. That we do so much better. We have a huge, a pretty substantial trade surplus with China in terms of services as well. And so those people have a stake in trade as also. So it's the services people, the massive number of businesses that like the cheap steel because it helps them. And indeed, hopefully, but of course, workers, unfortunately, are going to remain clueless. Their jobs depend on these cheap imports. Of course, not to mention all the people who flock to Walmart and other places like that that sell a lot of cheap imports from China.
Along with the cheap imports, there's also cheap labor, right? And Trump is very anti-immigrant. We seem to be going through. That's something that the Republican Party, I mean, people at National Review, the conservative magazine, actually chided Trump for a man who said he was going to deport 11 million illegal immigrants. They said he was not tough enough on immigration. That was one of the reasons they couldn't support him. We're in a spate of xenophobia and anti-immigrant sentiments. Why is it important that we allow immigrants, including low-skilled immigrants, to continue free entry into the country?
Well, including low-skilled immigrants, mainly because even, you know, this I discovered from a lot of very good economists on the subject and who actually look at the literature, even those economists who are not too keen on immigration concede that that our immigration policies, and of course over the last 30, 40 years, I find it, of course, totally heartening that tens of millions of poor people have come to this country and found jobs and found a better life. But even the economists who are critical of immigration concede that there are indeed net benefits from these people coming and providing their labor to our economy. They have high rates of employment, they're productive, they move up, they're innovative, so they do indeed contribute to the economy as a whole. The only thing, the only debate has to do with the idea of whether they hurt, to some degree at least, the prospects of the unskilled natives. So there is at least some argument. That's up for debate, mm-hmm. but at least let's they make that point. So let's say that while the immigrants benefit us in general, if they hurt the unskilled natives, then maybe something could be done. But that's a Band-Aid fix. Yeah. I mean, that just means that maybe we ought to charge the immigrants a bit of a tax if they want to come in. Maybe they're just to offset the effects. And by the way, I don't want any special policies toward unskilled people who lose their jobs, mm-hmm. because most people lose their jobs not to immigrants and not to foreign trade, but just to other factors. Sure. But if we want to have some kind of contribution that immigrants make in order to make up for the fact that they may be diminishing the wages of the unskilled by about 3 or 4%, that may happen, then we can have a Band-Aid solution there. But by and large, of course, if we are citizens of the world, then our immigration policy is fantastic. It boosts our growth overall, and of course, it benefits hugely the poor people of the world, yeah. who send remittances home to their relatives. It's a wonderful thing. But if it does harm the unskilled, then there might be the native unskilled, there might be some Band-Aid solutions whereby we can solve that problem. We don't have to throw out the entire immigration policy just because of that. There are solutions.
Now, you mentioned the term citizens of the world. You've yeah. outed yourself as a globalist, yeah. obviously, and yeah, you yeah, live yeah, in New yeah, York yeah. City. A place
yeah,
that
based
is,
on my Jewish background.
This is your rootless cosmopolite. I know that you have a soft spot for Ludwig von Mises, who may embody the citizen of the world in the liberal period as much or more yeah. than anybody.
That's right.
How do you convince, yeah. or have you thought about this? How do you convince people yeah. who are not their hearts are not hardened to yeah. change yeah. and everything, but like you say. To somebody in a small dying Midwestern city, which, yeah, if it's yeah. like, say, if it's a place like Cincinnati or Cleveland or Detroit, it has been losing people since 1950, but it seems to be accelerating. Yeah. And they say, bringing in these cheap imports, bringing in these cheap laborers, it's screwing me over. Is there a way to demonstrate to them that actually they're right to be upset or worried about their economic future, but they're looking in the wrong place for that, for the causes and the solutions?
Well, let's see now. The questions keep getting tougher, Nick. Let me see now. You're talking about somebody. I mean, of course, so many of those people actually are benefiting greatly by shopping at Walmart. Mm-hmm. Walmart has had the single most successful anti-poverty program of any institution over the last 30 years, cutting prices of goods continually, making cheap goods available to everyone. So they're helped there by those cheap goods, and Walmart likes to keep it a secret, but by and large, they're importing those goods from cheap labor from China. Mm-hmm. But that's probably not a good enough answer to your question, I guess, because you're talking about somebody who directly lost his job.
One of the things that Donald Trump has promised, and he was speaking directly to people in states like Ohio, Indiana, Wisconsin, Michigan, saying, "I am going to make not just America great, but the industrial Midwest great again." Is it possible for him or anybody to do that? I mean, it's kind of amazing when you look at manufacturing jobs as a percentage of the economy. They peaked, the labor force, they peaked in 1943 during World War II. I mean, they're not coming back. Yeah. But what do you do for people like that? Is there, an easy fix, what do you do?
Okay, you're making the question easier as you go on. That's good. Okay, now I would say, for example, that you by the way were very good at that last SOHO Forum debate against Walter Block, making fun of the idea that manufacturing jobs are so wonderful. This nostalgia on the part of progressives, of course, Trump isn't strictly speaking a left liberal progressive, but certainly the New York Times was recently wrapped just saying, "Oh my God, we lost manufacturing jobs." They used to be the bete noir of the left, the fact that people have to work in manufacturing.
Yeah, this was in Fritz Lang's Metropolis. It was dehumanizing, right? You were part of the machine that you were working on. And now suddenly everybody's Rosie the Riveter, and gosh,
and now
we miss her.
As, as you said, when Walter Block slapped you down, when you said that, you know, that probably, I guess, your dream is that your kids get manufacturing jobs. That's every dad's dream. And that's when, because Walter Block accused you of having your own industrial policy.
For my kids. And I say this not as actually, you know, factory work is very different than it was even 20 or 30 years ago. And it's, you know, any job is an honorable job as far as I'm concerned.
Yes.
And I've worked in factories, which is one of the reasons why I would rather not see them come back in a big way. But I guess, you know, another way of talking about this is you also recently wrote in Barron's, you wrote, you were the author of Barron's Guide for Economic Growth and Balancing the Budget, which I guess one of the ways out of this conundrum is to increase economic growth, as you know, you were talking about, from 2% to 3% or 2.5% to 3.5%. In the Barron's plan to balance the budget and kind of increase economic growth, you talk about cutting over the next 10 years $8.6 trillion in planned spending. And it's great because you say, we're going to cut that, but don't worry about it. We're going to balance the budget by cutting that from the expense side. We're not going to raise taxes. The heavy lifting will be done by cuts in spending. Talk a little bit about the cuts that you would make, and then after that, talk about why cutting spending would actually spur economic growth.
Well, I will. I just want to segue back briefly and say the following, that, you know, one of the great myths is that, to segue back to manufacturing jobs, manufacturing jobs now pay, as of December, an average hourly wage of $26.37. Construction pays $28.42. So it's better to work in construction than in manufacturing. Services pay $25.71. That's about 2% less. So for 2% less, you can get a services job. It's a complete myth that manufacturing jobs pay better. They pay worse than construction. They pay only barely better than service sector jobs. So again, there's nothing so great about manufacturing jobs. It's much better, by the way, that manufacturing is going the way of agriculture, in the sense that it's becoming increasingly mechanized, increasingly robotic. 1% of the workforce are producing more food than ever before. And by the way, manufacturing output is at a record high in this country, even though we only 9% of the workforce, of the private sector workforce, are in manufacturing. Right. I just wanted to kiss that off, but then go on to your question, which is I pointed out that while the while the explosion in the deficit and the explosion in spending is mainly due to the soaring entitlement spending on old people, I was not going to cut a whole lot of that with my $8.7 trillion. I cut a fair amount of it. More than half it comes from that. However, disproportionate in terms of the problem, I also cut nearly $1 trillion from defense, and I tried by and large, I know I didn't totally succeed, but I tried by and large to cut from defense only those things that even a relative hawk might not object to. It was Trump, for example, who pointed out that we're protecting Japan, we've got troops in Okinawa, we still have troops in Germany, we have troops in Italy. It's all a complete anachronism. It's just this, our sick industrial, military industrial complex at work. We can close those bases and save a lot of money.
Trump has also called out, and as I think you did, as you know, talking about a kind of weapons or hardware, you know, idiot program like the F-35 fighter jets.
That's right. I threw that one in too. Yes, indeed. Yes, yes. Yeah, because by and large, the weaponry becomes more and more complex because there's more money for the military contractor in producing the more complex and pricier weapon. So that was $1 trillion worth. I also went off to on went after some other entitlements. There was cuts in disability payments. I tried to scale it back to the expectation that there were no more disabled people than there really need to be. I didn't abolish that program, but I cut it back over time. All of these, by the way, would be phased in over time.
Right. And for instance, and in Social Security and disability, I mean, you only come up with, out of the total, I think it's $600 billion, and it's mostly by trimming or tightening up disability requirements and then pushing Social Security retirement age back a little bit each year, accelerating what we're already doing.
Exactly.
You have 1.8. Okay, go ahead.
Go ahead, 1.8. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, you were going to. No? You have $1.8 trillion coming from the repeal of Obamacare, about $2 trillion.
Well, but by the way, I also completely obliterated the $1.4 trillion in Obama-related taxes.
Right.
So I was honestly there. I actually had a tax cut. But then the most radical part of it was actually abolishing over time, over a 10-year period, housing and early development and the Department of Education. I guess that's difficult thing for people to put their minds around.
Well, talk about education, the Department of Education, because that was created in 1979 by Jimmy Carter was president. Ronald Reagan ran on a promise to get rid of it, and then he was elected. He took office in 81 and he kept it. But how did we get by without a Department of Education for so long?
Get by. Well, I think we got by a little bit better because federal government has been sending money to state to localities, and it's sort of been dictating how they're going to teach. We spend more money per student than ever before. The results are far worse than ever. Clearly, we need a private option, and that's of course why we have not spent any time applauding some of Trump's appointments, but what's her name, DeVoe?
Betsy DeVos,
as it's pronounced, who's going to be head of Department of Education for as long as I allow it to last, which will only be for the next 8-9 years. But she's at least struck a good note that clearly if Obama's going to send his kids to private school, why shouldn't poor people as be able to do that too with charters and vouchers? Why shouldn't, as Milton Friedman said, okay, we can have a food stamp program, but thank God the government doesn't run the grocery stores. So why do we need any government to run the school? Let's have something like the equivalent of a food stamp program for education. That's really, that indeed isn't even quite as radical as I would want to be, but certainly that's a step in the right direction. But getting to your question, Nick, about why it's good for growth is that
have $1.9 trillion also in other health care costs, which include Medicare and Medicaid. Medicare is the single biggest threat to budgetary solvency. How do you crack that nut? Because this is a program where the beneficiaries, everybody over 65, they get a lot of health care for very little tax that they pay and co-payments and premiums. That makes it very hard. It's very concentrated benefits, very dispersed costs. How do you sell the idea that wealthy old people should be paying a larger percentage, if not all, of their health care?
I'm not sure that that's specifically the idea I want to sell. If it's the idea that they should, I mean, what you're saying is that they should simply be on their own. I guess you, of course, hopefully, then what you're focusing on, then I guess, is an easy one. If the rich should pay for themselves, I mean, they shouldn't be. I guess the usual, the old canard among the progressives is that you want to bring the rich into the welfare state because you need those powerful people to support the welfare state. I mean, so you want to pay, you know, you want to support rich people on Social Security, you want to support people on Medicare, because then you have them as a special interest group that can champion these programs. But I mean, the obvious problem with that now is that you know, we're headed off a cliff. It's gotten so expensive and so out of control in terms of spending that, as the Congressional Budget Office keeps warning, the debt is soaring, and we're headed for a potential fiscal crisis. So it's no longer a workable idea. And then hopefully we can just say, you know, well, look, you know, those rich bastards should pay for themselves. We can just invoke the old populist.
But you don't get rich by paying your own bills, right? This is what Trump teaches us. You get other people to, you know, to do stuff, and then you stick them, right?
I mean, that's a great quote.
There's nobody as cheap as a billionaire. You know, you go driving with them, and they're, oh, do you have, you know, a dollar for the toll? So then talk about...
Please. Talk about what? Go ahead. I wanted to get to the hobby horse. You know, it was David Goldhill who taught me. He's the guy who wrote that famous article in the Atlantic, "How the American Healthcare System Killed My Father," who makes the point that we really don't know how Medicare nets out. He cites these hair-raising facts women who are already listed as in a condition where they're going to die on the fatal list are given mammograms. The incentive to pour services on these hapless people who don't know how to say no because it costs nothing has gotten to the point where we don't know how much of this medical care is actually harming them. And then, matter of fact, the cuts. I just wanted to defend my cuts. The cuts that I mentioned, by a lot of it just has to do with Medicare's own assessment of fraud. They have a broad category of fraud, which they think is about 12.5% of all the spending. That's probably a low estimate, because fraud by its very nature tends to be hidden. So I just talked about how if we can more effectively address the fraud in Medicare, we can solve the problem. See, with respect to Medicare, I was just basically, again, going for the low-hanging fruit.
Right.
But I mean, you're asking some important questions ultimately about Medicare. I by the way, support Michael Cannon of Cato, who wants Medicare spending to be phased into just completely subsidizing people's ability to buy private sector plans. That's a much more complicated, and I think basically the only way to go in the long run. But at least I pointed out the whole point of that, this exercise about $8.5 trillion, is that there is actually so much low hanging fruit, so much palpable waste in government, that you really can balance the budget by in 8 years if you simply go for that low-hanging fruit without raising taxes. The situation has gotten that bad, was my point. But of course, it was just a down payment on government. It was not hardly the kind of radical proposal I would make if I were, say, writing for Reason.
And of course, it's also certainly not the kind of radical proposal that the congressional Republicans are talking about. Their blueprint, which Rand Paul and a couple of other budget hawks have pointed out, would actually, you know, it has to do with a move to initiate the repeal of Obamacare. But they're talking about adding $9 trillion to the debt over the coming decade rather than cutting $9 trillion. So we'll talk a little bit about how does a reduction in government spending, what is the connection to economic growth? Because in the end, that can solve a lot of problems. It solves a lot of social problems. It solves, you know, economic problems. It solves standard of living problems. Why does cutting government spending, how does that help the economy grow faster?
Well, let me begin sort of perversely and say, To the extent that we are, you and I are minarchists, and we believe in the role of government, we know that we definitely want government to maintain a legal system and property rights. We want contracts enforced. We don't want violence in the streets. We want that, otherwise business can't operate. And so we need government to play a role. But of course, obviously, we are so far from that. We're clearly long past the point where government plays a positive role on balance. That's, of course, the whole point of the Economic Freedom Index. It plays a negative role. Among other things, the most direct point is that if you can get people off disability, then they'll come into the workplace. If you can abolish a HUD, then you can free up people to go into the private sector and do something productive with their lives. If you can unravel the crony capitalist system, then so many creative people who spend their time working for corporations, figuring out ways for corporations to dodge the law and find loopholes in it, their creativity can be devoted to thinking up ways to actually sell goods and services that people want to buy. So it's simply, of course, the low-hanging fruit point is simply freeing up all of those resources that would be better deployed to do something productive in the private sector. So that's good for growth. Then, of course, we have all the ways in which government stifles the private sector through regulation. So if we cut some of that, then we're also it's also good for growth in the long run to do that as well. So on both those counts, it's going to and by the way, I didn't even factor that in. I took the Congressional Budget Office numbers, and I didn't even mention that, by the way, if we are indeed reducing government, we'll probably have faster growth. And so and that would, in fact, actually produce more in the way of government revenue. I didn't even look at that feedback effect.
You know, one of the things in the way that you talk about things, you know, and I know this from previous conversations, that you're very interested in the Austrian School of Economics. And you talk not in mathematical precision or certainties, but rather in these large directional forces, which I, you know, I find compelling and interesting. Talk a little bit about how you became an advocate for freer markets and for a more libertarian approach, not you know, to economics and to life in general.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a very, you know, there's always a bit of a mystery about how I flipped from being a socialist in my 20s to becoming a free market person. Certainly, I had a strong, my mother was a member of the Communist Party, so I thought I was fairly just advanced by being a democratic socialist in my 20s. I came from a strong left-wing background, although I was always very favorably disposed to the peacenik, the peace movement. But I was initially excited by Noam Chomsky, who completely blasted my ideas about the way academicians work. I mean, Chomsky really did have a strong libertarian point. He pointed out that the academicians at MIT and Harvard and the rest, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the whole slew of them, were basically in bed with American imperialism. He had a great line that really stunned me. He said he wrote in his first book that Averill Harriman, a businessman, thinks he has a right to run the world because his grandfather owned railroads, and the new mandarins think they have a right to run the world because they're smart. He said, and if it's a forced choice, he said, I'd rather choose Averill Harriman because even if he's wrong, his grandfather still ran railroads, so he's going to admit he's wrong. But if the mandarins are wrong, they're going to be defensive because they're not proves that they're not smart anymore. And so it sort of blew my mind that this socialist is actually saying, let's trust Averill Harriman more.
Now, can I ask, what year were you born? And you grew up in New York and Manhattan? Okay, and so you grew up?
Well, Westchester, mostly Westchester.
New York area.
Westchester. New York area, sure. 1944.
So did you participate in peace marches and things like that in the 60s?
Yeah. Oh, sure. No, I was I was definitely going to become, I was in Chicago in 1968, sure. Uh-huh. And although I wasn't part of the crowd, I mean, they were trying to provoke the cops, and I was really disgusted with that. And I wasn't part of the crowd that provoked the cops in front of the Democratic Convention and got the heads beat in. So I was a little bit of a on the sidelines there. But I definitely was not going to go to war. I was a draft dodger. I would have gone to prison rather than serve in the Vietnam War. But Chomsky certainly moved me by pointing out that you really can't trust the intellectuals, that by and large, that they are generally in bed with power. Mm-hmm. And then I had been teaching economics. I wanted to see if I was going to become, you know, what kind of socialist was I? I went to the New School. I studied under Robert Heilbronner, who's the best-selling economist. I actually became his research and writing assistant, which helped my career greatly because he was a big name.
But, did you work on the Worldly Philosophers then, or was it?
No, I didn't. Okay. Heilbronner, of course, that was published in 1953.
Oh, okay.
Heilbronner had already become like world famous.
Yeah.
But I was in his class, and so he had me. I wrote parts of his textbook, and I wrote his parts of his newsletter. And so, I was his boy, and he already, the Worldly Philosophers was so famous. I got a job in Wall Street from that, amazingly, because so many, some of the Wall Street types had read the Worldly Philosophers.
There was nothing better than to be a left-wing economist to get a job in a white shoe
right.
firm.
But
so then, did you have a Kronstadt moment, or what was the turning point where you're suddenly
The next part of it. Well, the next part of it was that because Chomsky had sort of primed me, I was teaching economics, and I was completely – I was bored. I was getting the PhD. It was easy enough to get a teaching job in economics even before the PhD because there was always a demand. I was teaching at City University in Richmond, and I was getting increasingly bored with the subject. Nothing seemed to work for me intellectually. And then I was browsing the New School Library a couple of times, picked up a couple of times Murray Rothbard's book, Man, Economy, and State, two-volume work on the economy. And then maybe by the fourth time, I finally sat down and read it. And that was my big transformation, my big eureka moment, reading Rothbard. And then after reading Rothbard's discussions, not just of the Austrian approach, but also of his critical discussions of so much else about all of the mainstream gobbledygook about imperfect competition, all of that made immense sense to me. And then I visited the Laissez-Faire bookshop down in downtown Manhattan every weekend, bought a couple of books, and I read virtually everything in that shop, from Hayek, all of Mises, everything else that Rothbard had written. And I recognized that it all came together, that Keynes, John Maynard Keynes, was another one of the new Mandarins, that Chomsky, what Chomsky had taught me about politics, I could teach Chomsky about economics. In fact, still to this day, I'm planning to try to do that.
Yeah.
But, Chomsky, that the whole point is that the Hayekian view, of course, that the economy cannot be run by a bunch of smart economists, cannot be run by the Galbraiths of this world, who are so proud of the fact that in Galbraith's case that he fixed prices during World War II, that it has to be left to the market to do, and so it all came together, and so that's pretty much a thumbnail of how I evolved in that direction.
That is the Laissez-Faire bookstore in New York was a real kind of a mecca for a lot of people, for sure. You are the Laissez-Faire bookstore obviously closed down many years ago. But one of the things that you're doing now is you've revived a really fun and interesting place for debate and discussion, both within the libertarian moment and between libertarians and other people, called the Soho Forum.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that. That was, you had me speak at an event, which was a lot of fun, as you mentioned, with Walter Block. We had a good time, very spirited conversation. You've got an event coming up with Matt Welch, which I think might top it and might actually come to blows.
Yeah.
But talk a little bit about what the Soho Forum is, what you do, and what you hope to accomplish with
it. Sure. The January event on January 17th might come to blows, as though the event with you and Walter didn't come to blows.
Yeah.
But, of course, it was just verbal blows. But it was a very great event. When you, I think, Nick spoke very eloquently and memorably, and I say that because we do have podcasts and videos of all of our events.
Mm-hmm.
I think you rose to the occasion, Nick, debating Walter Block on November 1st about who to vote for by saying, you chose Gary Johnson. But you chose Gary Johnson because you basically said that libertarians, really, it's not the role of libertarians to choose a candidate from either of the two major parties. And I think think you were quite persuasive in that regard, and it was a memorable event that I recommend.
By the same token, I did lose the debate because you do the Oxford-style thing. And now talk a little bit about the event that my colleague, Reason Editor-at-Large Matt Welch, will be doing on the 17th.
You lost by only about 3 points.
But it's still, come on, this is, now you're sounding like Hillary Clinton, for God's sake. It's like, okay. A loss is a loss.
Yeah, well, this is the other thing that, as a matter of fact, it can now be revealed that it was Jim Epstein who proposed this, that son of mine who works at Reason.
Yes.
He said, you know, Jonathan Chait is coming out with a book about Obama, and didn't you say that the way to lure progressives to a debate with a libertarian would be to say, hey, here's a book signing opportunity for you. You've published a book. That, of course, people who publish a book, as you and I know, I know perhaps more than you, you become supplicants. You're begging for the opportunity to speak about your book and to sign it, and you'll do it for nothing. So I wrote Jonathan Chait into my, and I respect him for this because I've gotten a lot of turndowns from progressives who do not want to step into the ring with a libertarian.
Right.
Jonathan Chait promptly wrote me that he would indeed be happy to defend his book about Obama, which technically is not going to be published for another few days, although I have a copy of it. It's about the greatness of Obama. The resolution is based upon his program, his record of accomplishment, Obama is one of our greatest presidents. Now, clearly, that's a difficult proposition for Jonathan Chait to defend.
Sure.
We're bringing Matt Welch in to take the negative on that. And what we do emphasize, each debater gets 80 minutes up on the stage. There's 30 minutes of questioning that's part of that 80 minutes, but each gets a lot of opportunity to talk in paragraphs and to explain his case, and I found that it's worked quite well. We're drawing capacity crowds in each case, and we already have a capacity crowd signed up for the January 17th event. Yeah.
Well. And what is the best place if people are interested in getting more information? And as you mentioned, there is video, there is podcasts of Soho Forum events. Where should they go for that?
Yeah, it's the SohoForum.org. That's continuous. SohoForum.org. SohoForum.org is where you can get that.
It was, and I have to say, the only one I've been to so far is the one that I participated in, but it was in a great theater. It was in the Village or...
45 Bleecker Street,
It was just, it's a wonderful vibe, and it reminded me of, you know, when I was young and green, and I suspect when you were young and green, and these were different periods, but, you know, of just like electrifying, I mean, real conversation, people arguing in good faith about ideas that matter. It's a great scene, and it's exactly
right. And
plenty
of food and wine.
Yes.
Yes, and also the second part of it is for people to get together. You arrive early, you can schmooze, and then we end at around 8:10, and we go on for another hour with wine and cheese and other great food that we serve. The wine costs money, the beer costs a few bucks, but it's also a social occasion, and so we want to emphasize that as well. Thanks, Nick, and I guess unfortunately you're not going to come to cheer Matt Welch on Tuesday evening.
I would like to, but I don't think it's going to happen, but I will be cheering you, Gene, on in your great work at Barron's as well as the work at the Soho Forum, so thank you very much.
Thanks again. Talk to you soon.
We've been talking with Gene Epstein of Barron's. Go to barrons.com to check out his work there. He's also the proprietor of the Soho Forum, a monthly debate society that is held in New York. The next event will be January 17th, where Matt Welch of Reason will square off against Jonathan Chait about Barack Obama's presidential legacy. This has been the Reason Podcast. I'm Nick Gillespie. Thanks so much for listening. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there.